I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Robert F. Kennedy is perhaps best remembered for his work fighting organized crime and fighting for civil rights for African Americans. He advocated for the poor and opposed the escalation of the war in Vietnam. He was assassinated on June 5, 1968, as he campaigned for the Democratic presidential nomination. RFK wasn't always the liberal icon we remember. Larry Tye has written a biography on this complex and controversial member of the Kennedy family, Bobby Kennedy, the making of a liberal lion. Larry Tye joins us in our Woodsole studio. Good to see you again.
Great to be back again.
I always love talking about your books. There's so much research that goes into these, which we'll talk about. But I have to talk about one of the most surprising things I found comes early in the book, and that is his relationship with Joe McCarthy. Who knew?
Yes. So if I can tell a quick story about that, that sort of captures the two sides of that relationship. It's 1957. Joe McCarthy dies of cirrhosis of the liver from drinking too much, and he has a huge funeral in Appleton, Wisconsin. And a plane flies in from Washington with 17 senators, a bunch of congressmen, and lots of other dignitaries, and it empties out. And they're whisked away from the airport to the town in Appleton where the funeral is being held. And after everybody else clears out of the runway, a small, quiet figure comes off the plane, and he looks around to make sure nobody is there, and he bums a ride from Green Bay to Appleton with a reporter. And this is a congressional staffer named Robert F. Kennedy. And at the funeral, he sits up in the choir loft. And at the graveside, he's off on the side so nobody will notice him. And after the funeral, he asks all the reporters there if they would mind not mentioning in their stories that Robert F. Kennedy was there. And to me, this is the two sides of Robert F. Kennedy. One, on the one hand, he was a loyal friend. He realized that Joe McCarthy was the first guy to give him a chance and give him a job. Joe McCarthy was a great buddy of Joe Kennedy, Bobby's dad, for whom Bobby would do anything. And this is the guy who understood that you stand by a friend and you show up at his funeral, even when Jack Kennedy had told him to stay away. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, there's Bobby, the forever politically savvy, behind-the-scenes manipulator, who doesn't want anybody to know he's there. And while he is loyal, he wants to make sure that he's not going to hurt Jack or hurt himself in terms of their future liberal politics.
But in the beginning, when he gets this job with Joe McCarthy, he believes in this anti-communism sort of thought, right? I mean, and in the beginning, he's on board with this.
So Bobby Kennedy's politics in the beginning were his dad's politics, and it was definitely anti-communist, and it was definitely believing that Joe McCarthy was the one politician in Washington with the guts to stand up and say communism is wrong, and it's not just wrong in terms of the Soviet Union, that we've got to root out every communist we can find behind every pillar at the State Department.
Mm. All right, so we'll go back a little bit. Bobby's the middle child. In many ways, he's like his father, Joe.
He is, and it's ironic because he's the one that Joe least notices when he's growing up. Joe jokingly called him the runt of his litter, and the fact was Bobby was physically smaller and was stuck in that middle group of kids. There were the stars at the top, Kathleen, Joe Jr., and Jack, the older kids that Bobby was grooming for great things. There were the younger kids, like Bobby, who he basically didn't pay much attention to. So Bobby spent much of his youth trying to be noticed by his father and trying to be like his father. And Joe Kennedy would later joke that Bobby was the one who knew how to hate like him. The truth is that Bobby was the one who was as smart, as savvy, and as wily as Joe was. Mm.
So as Joe's grooming the older kids, Bobby's really the favorite of Rose.
He is. Rose had hopes that some of her kids would show her passion for the Catholic Church that she did. And if it was anybody that she thought would be a perfect priest, it was Bobby Kennedy, who was absolutely the most prudish, the most sanctimonious, and the most faithful to his faith of her nine kids. Mm.
Lots of rules in that Kennedy household. They would grill those kids. They were afraid to be late to the dinner table. You wrote, Joe expected the children in the dining room 5 minutes before mealtime. It was a rule so strictly enforced that Kennedys were known to abandon whatever boat they were on and swim for their lives so they would not break it. Rose and Joe drilled into their offspring the importance of knowing what was happening in the world by quizzing them at mealtime, and they fine-tuned everyone's language skills by insisting that only Spanish or French be spoken on specified evenings at the dinner table. That's a stressful dinner table.
It's not exactly what you call relaxed or fun. On the other hand, it produced some extraordinary kids.
Yeah, sure did. So Joe's expectations of Bobby were not very high in Bobby's early career, right?
They weren't, and everything that Bobby did in his early career was stage managed by Joe, including Joe calling the guy, Joe McCarthy, who would stop by Palm Beach for drinks every time he was in town, would flirt with the Kennedy girls, and to whom Joe Kennedy had given a substantial enough campaign contribution that when he called, McCarthy listened.
So lots has been written about Robert F. Kennedy and the Kennedy family. So why did you want to write this book?
For two reasons. One is I had grown up in the era in a place, Massachusetts, where the Kennedys were gospel, and you couldn't help growing up here without their being infused into your life. In my case, I went to high school with David Kennedy, Bobby's middle child, and that made the interest even greater. But there was also something else. I had spent most of my life as a journalist, and I never understood why some of the hardest-edged journalists I knew, my mentors, people like David Halberstam, who had won a Pulitzer Prize for questioning U.S. involvement at an early stage in Vietnam, why these guys fell in love with Bobby Kennedy. They wrote valentines of books. They took time off to work for him. And I wanted to get what it was in this hard-edged politician that could so touch these hard-edged reporters that they would give up their chastity.
Mm. All right, so tons of research went into this book for sure. So how long did it take?
It took, for me as a journalist, forever, which was 3 years. It was 400 to 450 interviews. It was reading 500 books. And it was spending more time, having more fun, probing more about all the different Kennedys. It was more fun than any author has a right to claim.
All right, so tell us about his relationship with Roy Cohn. This is with Joe McCarthy early on. They didn't hit it off right from the bat.
So Roy Cohn has come back, by the way, onto the scene these days because we now understand that Roy Cohn was an early mentor of one Donald J. Trump. And Roy Cohn, for your listeners who don't remember, was Joe McCarthy's trusted, brilliant, young, arrogant aide. And Bobby Kennedy and Roy Cohn were like water and oil from the very beginning. Bobby hated the fact that Roy Cohn had control over him. Bobby blamed all of McCarthy's excesses on Roy Cohn. And when Bobby Kennedy formed an enemy, they generally were a lifelong enemy. And Roy Cohn was one of the great triumvirate of Bobby's enemies over his life.
I want to read what you say. This is what Bobby says about Joe McCarthy. The truth is he had always been of two minds about the controversial senator. I liked him, and yet at times he was terribly heavy-handed, Bobby said. He was a very complicated character. His whole method of operation was complicated because he would get a guilty feeling and get hurt after he had blasted somebody. He wanted so desperately to be liked. He was so thoughtful and yet so unthoughtful in what he did to others. He was sensitive and yet insensitive. He didn't anticipate the results of what he was doing. He was thoughtful of his friends, and yet he could be cruel to others. Precisely what people would say over the years about Bobby.
It's true. So one of my most cherished of all my interview subjects was Ethel Kennedy. And Ethel explained to me that for much of the world, McCarthy conveyed the image of a monster. But for them, he was somebody who adored their oldest daughter, Kathleen, who would come by and have fun with them. And he was a charming guy on a personal level, which is in a way what makes Joe McCarthy an intriguing figure. The idea that he could have these two personalities was amazing, and Bobby Kennedy understood that nuance. On the other hand, if you look at what Bobby Kennedy said about Joe McCarthy, it became more nuanced over the years. At the beginning, it was 90% positive. By the end, it was sort of 30-70, that as Bobby partly got more liberal and understood that this was a stigma that he carried with him, he felt like he had to explain and justify McCarthy. And it was also Bobby Kennedy over the years came to understand not just what somebody was out to do, but whether there were victims left in their wake. And as he became more sensitive and more tender himself, he became more sensitive to all the people who were left in McCarthy's wake as his really sad victims.
They say Ethel Kennedy said that he was perceived as a monster. Do you think he was misunderstood? Do you think a lot of what he's blamed for was more Roy, or was it?
So I think everybody, as you look deeper, becomes more flesh and blood. And the people who look like they're all monster actually often have tender sides like Joe McCarthy. And I also think that it was Ethel and Bobby seeing a side of him that unfortunately his victims never saw in his hearings where he was crucifying them.
No. All right. His other enemy, if you will, was Jimmy Hoffa, head of the Teamsters Union. And you write, whenever Bobby would get tangled up, this is Jimmy Hoffa talking, whenever Bobby would get tangled up in one of his involved questions, I would wink at him. That invariably got him. Mr. Chairman, he'd shout, would you please instruct the witness to stop making faces at me? I laughed out loud when I read that.
So Jimmy Hoffa was a huge character. And the funny thing is, at the end, while they were lifelong enemies, they were so much alike. They were both people who were tenacious in pursuing what they saw as ultimate good. Bobby Kennedy saw himself as going after a corrupt union leader who was undermining and selling out his rank and file. Jimmy Hoffa saw Bobby Kennedy as this government guy who really was anti-union and who didn't get that it took a tough union leader to fight against the big trucking companies. Jimmy Hoffa was overwhelmingly elected repeatedly to lead the biggest union in America. And clearly he had something going with union members that Bobby didn't get. And yet he was also, according to the kind of evidence that Bobby was digging up, the corruption charges were pretty compelling, even if it was difficult to make them stick in court.
Mm. And they did have a meeting. Talk about the dinner where they, and I guess there's different versions of what happened at this dinner.
It was a wonderful dinner brought together by somebody who worked with Hoffa, who thought that he and Bobby Kennedy, if they actually met one another, would like one another. So it was a dinner with just the three of them, this middle guy and Hoffa and Kennedy. And what Hoffa didn't know at the dinner is that Bobby was running an undercover sting operation at the time. What Kennedy didn't know is that Hoffa was even more wily than Bobby was and would actually evade most of his indictments over the years. And this one night they came together ended in a classic moment. And what the truth is of that moment, nobody knows, because Jimmy and Bobby offered such differing versions. But it seems like they got down on the floor and Indian arm wrestled, what it was called back then. And the fact is, who won and who proposed it depends on which one of their memoirs you believe. But it was the two of them ultimately showing to one another, or trying to, that they were the tougher.
So funny. All right, let's talk about Bobby as Jack's campaign manager and those phone calls on Martin Luther King's behalf.
So lots of people think that in 1960, they know why Jack Kennedy won one of the narrowest presidential races in history. Was it because he had dead people from Chicago voting for him, brought back from the grave by Mayor Richard Daley? Was it because he looked better than Richard Nixon with his 5 o'clock shadow in those famous presidential debates? Well, the one who offered, I think, the most definitive answer was Dwight Eisenhower, the incumbent president, who said it was because of two phone calls the Kennedys made. One we knew about was Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy called Coretta Scott King, Martin Luther King's wife, when Martin had been arrested in Atlanta for a pretty trumped up charge and was put in jail. Coretta was worried that he would be killed in jail, the famous Georgia prison system, which wasn't exactly something that looked fondly upon blacks and certainly not upon civil rights leaders. So Jack Kennedy calls and just expresses sympathy, nothing else. And he gets lots of credit for doing that. What nobody knew was that Bobby Kennedy, who supposedly had been outraged at Jack making the phone call and thought that it could cost them votes among segregationist Southerners, Bobby Kennedy, in fact, was making his own phone call to the sentencing judge, which anybody in your listening audience who knows anything about the law will know was probably unethical. The sentencing judge says, sure, it's easy to release him. There are lots of grounds to do it. It happens, and it wasn't until generations later that we knew exactly what Bobby had done behind the scenes. What happened as a result of that was that in every black church in America, there were pamphlets that went out the Sunday before the election saying, don't vote for the candidate without a heart, Richard Nixon. Vote for this compassionate candidate, Jack Kennedy. That was a direct result of those phone calls. It changed the election results in five critical states to the extent that Dwight Eisenhower and Teddy White, the ultimate chronicler of elections back then, said that that was what provided the margin of victory. And it was classic Bobby, taking nothing for granted, trying to solidify the white segregationist vote in the South at the same time he was trying to build up the black vote. All Richard Nixon had to have done to win was to get the same percentage of the black vote that Dwight Eisenhower had gotten 4 years before. It was, after all, the Republican Party of Lincoln, But Bobby saw that that didn't happen.
He was a very clever campaign manager. Like you said, he didn't take anything for granted. And you know, he did what he felt he had to do to get the job done.
He did. And he has become the model. Richard Nixon, who became known as Tricky Dick, said he learned all of his tricks from Bobby Kennedy in 1960. And Bobby was the ultimate good guy, bad guy, behind the scenes, do what it takes to win kind of guy.
Talk about how he dealt with the anti-Catholic bias of the time.
So what he had Jack do in a very famous speech, and what Bobby actually did himself in another speech, was taken on directly. Basically, say to America, are you as open-minded as you think you are? And Bobby Kennedy thought he knew the answer, that if you played the issue, the fear of the Pope somehow taking control of the White House if Jack Kennedy, a Catholic, would become president, Bobby confronted America with that directly and said, look, if you stand for everything this country supposedly stands for, you will not pay attention to my brother's religion. You'll pay attention to my brother. It worked. He won in heavily Catholic states in the early primaries, and he managed to win the Catholic vote and win a lot of Protestant votes because people wanted to show that they were tolerant. Mm-hmm. And he also may have been behind some dirty tricks, which was sending to Catholic households anti-Catholic literature to ensure that they would turn out to fight this anti-Catholic move. Bobby Kennedy may have been, we don't know for sure, but he may have been the orchestrator of some of the most creative dirty tricks ever.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Larry Tye. His book is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Larry Tye, New York Times bestselling author, about his new book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Let's talk a little about the relationship between the brothers, Jack and Bobby, and their differences. This is Arthur Schlesinger Jr. who wrote, John Kennedy was a realist brilliantly disguised as a romantic, Robert a romantic stubbornly disguised as a realist.
So that's beautifully capturing what I think was the truth. It looked like Bobby was the hard-edged political operative, when in fact he was the one who had a much more compelling sense of tenderness and cared about people who might have been hurt during the campaign and elsewhere. And the two brothers had an unusual relationship. They started out with Jack dismissing Bobby the way many older brothers do younger brothers. They then took a trip when they both were young, and a trip that was mandated by Joe Kennedy, the father, to Asia. Jack didn't want to bring Bobby along. Bobby would love to have gone anywhere that his big brother Jack went. They go to Asia. Jack Kennedy gets deathly ill, and it's Bobby who sits by his bedside and nurses him back to health in Japan. And Jack Kennedy realized in that trip that this wasn't the runt of his dad's litter, that this was a very sensitive, thoughtful guy, and a guy who was totally devoted to him. And that stuck with him forever. Fast forward to today, when I sit down writing this book with Ethel Kennedy and ask her to explain the relationship. And she says it wasn't just that they could finish one another's sentences by the end. It was they almost didn't even have to talk. That just by knowing one another so well and watching their hand motions, watching their facial expressions, they knew where the other one was going to come out. And it was the kind of relationship we talk in rhetorical terms about co-presidencies a lot. Well, there are never really co-presidencies. The president's never going to give up power. The closest America has ever seen to a co-presidency was when Jack Kennedy was president and Bobby was his attorney general, his pseudo CIA director, his advisor on anything that mattered.
Yeah. But before I'm going to talk about that, but first I want to talk about Ethel Kennedy. She seemed the perfect match for him, didn't she?
They had the kind of relationship that was extraordinary. Bobby was the youngest of the Kennedy kids to get married. He was deeply and forever in love with Ethel. They were so much alike. They looked alike. They had similar senses of humor. And yet, where Bobby was really in a social setting shy and Ethel was incredibly relaxed and talkative, they complemented one another in brilliant ways, to the point where when I talk to Ethel, she's not only still wearing her wedding ring, she says that why would she ever have thought of getting remarried, because Bobby's still up there looking down and he's still part of her life.
Mm. Yeah, that's something they believe, that they've moved on to a better place. You know, her children who've died, her husband. And talk about the rumors of infidelity. We heard a lot about that with Jack Kennedy and somewhat with Bobby Kennedy. And her theory on this was he always came home.
Right. And so what I can say definitively is that Bobby was the most puritanical of the Kennedy men. Now, in fact, we know his dad, Joe, had affairs We know that his brother Jack did. Whether Bobby did or not, there are always rumors. The Kennedys are subject to more rumors than anybody. But what mattered is how devoted in the end he always was to Ethel and to the 10 kids with an 11th on the way when he was killed.
Yeah. This was a very competitive family. And talk about the story of Ethel bringing Andy Williams to dinner.
So she brings Andy Williams. This happened again and again with people that they brought in. Andy Williams was a great star and entertainer, and he would come in with something wrong with his leg, or people would come in with a broken arm, and she'd say, "That's not going to stop you from being out there playing tennis with us, is it?" And Ethel, who was out there playing tennis into the last months of her pregnancy, they were incredibly competitive with everything, to the point where they would go out on the football field, and unless you came back bloodied, not just dirty, that it wasn't a real game. And that was partly the runt of the litter trying to prove himself. It was partly just the way Kennedys had fun.
Yeah, and she got kudos for bringing, it was like, who could bring the best dinner guest? Joe would give you points for that.
He'd give you points and he'd give you money. Who brought the best dinner guest for him?
Yeah. And there were rules for the guests, right? I mean,
there were rules for everything. There were rules on how to play football that didn't look like anybody else's rules. And there were rules that changed depending on what the Kennedy team looked like in terms of size and quickness. There were rules for everything, but nothing more inviolate than the rules for politics, which were anything that goes on in the Kennedy compound stays in the Kennedy compound. You don't talk to reporters and you don't talk to authors.
Right. Now, there was also a scene in the book where Joe Kennedy's getting a little bit upset about how much money everybody is spending. And he looks to Ethel and says, "And you're the worst of the bunch." But Jack kind of saves it. I guess she walks out of the room, but Jack saves the day. He says, "Looks like Dad's just going to have to make some more money."
Exactly. Jack knew how to diffuse everything. And that was the perfect way in which Jack could say things like that with eloquence, with sort of spontaneous grace. And it was much tougher for Bobby to live up to that standard. And yet, by the end, Bobby was known for his spontaneous grace as well.
Mm. All right. As Bobby becomes attorney general, he didn't let politics or political favors get in the way of his cases. And this could be a problem for Jack, who was president at the time.
It was. It was an embarrassment for him. There were more Democrats who were indicted by Bobby's Justice Department than there were Republicans. And Bobby essentially took the cases not just where he wanted to take them, but where his professional staff told them he ought to take them. And there were very few exceptions, and the exceptions actually were standouts. One exception was Frank Sinatra. And Frank Sinatra had been a close enough friend of the family that on the one hand, Bobby made Jack sever his ties with Sinatra, who had these questionable ties with organized crime. On the other hand, Bobby's Justice Department never went after Sinatra the way his professional staff thought they ought to.
And the cases he did go after, I mean, he made sure that every I was dotted, every T. He made sure that this was a solid case.
He did. So he started his tenure as attorney general as possibly the least qualified person to be attorney general in the history of attorneys general in America. He had never tried a case in court. He was, other than being Jack's brother, not a whole lot of qualifications for being the nation's chief law enforcement officer. He ended by being arguably the best attorney general of his era and possibly ever because of the way he went after organized crime, because of the way he took cases no matter what the politics were, and because of what he did in the end with issues like civil rights.
Interesting. Jack didn't really want him to be the attorney general to start with. And Joe was like, "No, he's going to be attorney general." And Jack actually gets two family friends to try to talk to Joe. Jack couldn't go to him, I guess, himself and say, "Dad, I don't want to do this." He's the president of the United States, and Dad's still telling him what to do.
So the only person that Jack couldn't tell what he was going to do and then do it was his dad. And Joe Kennedy, I think, wanted Bobby to be attorney general for two reasons. One is because he felt Bobby had earned it and proven himself, most notably by running a brilliant campaign and making Jack president. The other is, if you're somebody who operated in the shadows of the law the way that Joe Kennedy did, it didn't hurt having your son be the chief law enforcement officer.
Yeah. And he won out in that one. Jack, as much as he tried to get family friends to convince Joe otherwise, Joe won.
It's true. It is definitely true that Jack had his doubts. Now, the big question is whether or not Bobby had his doubts. And Bobby always made it look like he was a reluctant candidate. I don't think he was so reluctant.
Yeah, he was very clever, that's for sure. All right. In addition to going after the mafia and organized crime, he prosecuted, as you said, two congressmen, three state Supreme Court justices, five mayors, two police chiefs, and three sheriffs who were all Democrats.
extraordinary record.
Yeah. His zeal to get Hoffa actually made people feel sorry for Hoffa.
It did. So it was the two things in Bobby's life that came closest to a vendetta were his zeal to get Jimmy Hoffa and his ongoing zeal to get Roy Cohn. And in both cases, Bobby had lots of good reasons. Those were people who had serious flaws, and Bobby thought they deserved to be in jail. Whereas Roy Cohn, he never softened on. Hoffa, once he finally put him in jail, there was a sense, according to Bobby's close buddy Ken O'Donnell, that he wanted Hoffa to be in jail, but he didn't want him to suffer, and that having won the battle, he had a little more empathy for Jimmy Hoffa.
Mm. You had access to the Cuban Missile Crisis tapes. Talk about Bobby's role in that.
So Bobby's role we first learned about in Bobby's book, 13 Days, which was the definitive story at that moment of the missile crisis. This was the inside story. And Bobby told about being this extraordinary dove, an essential element in his brother going with the middle ground of a blockade instead of an invasion of Cuba. And that was, in fact, where Bobby ended up at. It's not where he started out at. He started out as one of the most vociferous hawks calling for an air attack on Cuba and essentially thinking that we had to be aggressive and this was the time to truly take out Castro. There was one other role that Bobby didn't talk about in the book, which was his role in spawning the crisis in the first place. He had led this ongoing surreptitious campaign to try to dislodge Castro that was called Operation Mongoose. That meant everything from sabotaging the crops to trying to undermine Fidel Castro's political position to authorizing, and it's unclear how directly, but to essentially spawning campaigns to assassinate Fidel Castro. It was that that led Castro and Moscow to think that they needed missiles in Cuba to protect Cuba from this big, bad America next door. And in a lot of ways, they were right.
Mm. When you think about that whole Cuban Missile Crisis and, you know, that fine line that we walked there and hear, you know, Bobby saying, we need an airstrike. This was a really tough time for Jack Kennedy and his presidency.
It was a tough time for everybody. And also, it became the defining moment. It was Jack Kennedy's most brilliant moment where he was the one who really called for the blockade and talked down his generals. It was Bobby's brilliant moment. In the end, he rallied support for Jack's blockade route. And the thing that we never learned out about until years afterwards, Bobby and Jack orchestrated with the Russians a trade of missiles. You take your missiles out of Cuba, we will take our Jupiter missiles out of Turkey. And that was a trade that Bobby insisted the Russians not portray as a quid pro quo. One would happen, the missiles would go from Cuba. Months later, as seemingly an independent move, the missiles would come out of Europe, our missiles. And in fact, it was a direct trade. And Bobby told the Russian ambassador that someday he might want to run for office. And so they had to keep this a secret.
Mm. All right. So let's talk about the relationship with Dean Rusk.
Not much of a relationship. Bobby Kennedy, that was one of Bobby Kennedy's bad guys. He thought Rusk was a weak Secretary of State. He accused him of things that were unfair in terms of his not playing a real role in the missile crisis and maybe coming close to a mental breakdown. It was Bobby being tough on his enemies, and Dean Rusk's kids have never forgiven Bobby Kennedy for it.
Mm-hmm. You've got Dean Rusk's kids and Jimmy Hoffa's kids who both didn't think too highly of him.
Neither of whom are big Bobby Kennedy fans. And it was, again, Bobby being tough. And I think with Dean Rusk, he was right that he probably would have been replaced as Secretary of State in a second Kennedy administration. And Bobby also liked being Jack's Secretary of State himself. He gave as much advice on foreign policy as the Secretary of State did.
Wow. All right. So what was it like for you listening to those tapes, the Cuban Missile Crisis tapes?
So I grew up with all of this stuff. I was infused with it. The Cuban Missile Crisis, when I was a kid, was the moment that we were all most scared. In school, we learned how to duck under our desks and what we're supposed to do in the event of a crisis. And so listening to those tapes was illuminating, partly because it brought me back to the history, and partly because it told the story that Bobby Kennedy had left out of 13 Days. Now, he and Jack had planted the tapes in the cabinet room, secret tape recording equipment, and he must have thought that this stuff would never become public, because he would not have told the story he did if he knew it could be contradicted by his own voice on the tapes that he had set up.
Mm. Why do you think he wrote what he wrote in 13 Days?
I think that it was for very clear-cut political reasons. The book initially was going to come out and was going to be one of the defining documents in Jack's 64 re-election campaign. Jack is killed. The book comes out later. Bobby knows he wants to run for president and burnish his credentials as a dove. He had not been a dove on Vietnam. He had not been a dove in the early days on Cuba. And so he was just trying to write a book that was the proper political spin for his campaign.
Mm. Let's talk about the assassination of John F. Kennedy. That hit Bobby really hard.
So if Bobby Kennedy had a single epiphany moment, it was that day in November of 1963. He was sitting at the pool at their estate in McLean, Virginia, when he gets a phone call on the White House hotline, and it's his least favorite person in the administration, J. Edgar Hoover, calling to give him the horrible news that his brother had been shot. Bobby manages to lose in that one phone call and the next one saying that his brother was dead. He manages to lose at the same moment his brother, his boss, and his best friend. He had lost his sense for being. He had defined himself so much by what he was doing for Jack over these years. He went for the next month through an extraordinary period where he somehow rallied and found the strength to be the strong one in the family and to help keep the country together in its moment of mourning. But when the country started pulling it together, when his family started pulling it together, Bobby lost it. He went through what today we would define as clinical depression, wondering what he was all about. Should he be a school teacher? Should he use his family inheritance to travel in Europe? And it wasn't until he decided to run for senator from New York that he managed to pull it back together and give himself a sense of purpose. Those were not good months for him. He also learned during that time to read Greek tragedies, and he saw the Kennedy hubris in those tragedies, and he saw the idea that life wasn't all good and all straight up. It was the way it had been for him with losing his brother. Lots of hurdles over the lifetime.
It's amazing when you think about, you know, as he kind of rallied to pull the family together, and even Rose Kennedy at the funeral. This funeral was, I mean, how many people came? It was like thousands and thousands of people. But she was very, you know, her charming, and, you know, because she had to be kind of a thing.
They
mourned in private. You didn't see this publicly.
So that's where Bobby learned how to do that. But he ended up outdoing even his mother in terms of how to do that, how to rally people together. And Bobby, in the midst of assigning people different roles, was even assigning Rose her role. And this was classic Kennedy. What happens behind the compound walls is what happens behind the compound walls, and people should wait 50 years to find out about it.
Yeah. Talk about his relationship with Jackie.
Interesting relationship with Jackie. Bobby had always been incredibly thoughtful to Jackie. When she lost a baby through a miscarriage, it was Bobby who was at her bedside when she woke up, not Jack. Anytime that Jackie needed Bobby, Bobby was there, and she never needed Bobby more than after she lost Jack. Bobby was there for Jackie. Bobby was there for John and Carolyn. He was the dutiful brother-in-law and the great friend to hers. Mm.
Interesting that Jackie had put, for John F. Kennedy's funeral, she had put gloves on John, and Robert took them off.
Not manly.
Yeah. As I said, not manly. That's not the image you want to portray. So he really had, this was sort of second nature to him, this whole, you know, the campaigning and image and all of that just came to him naturally.
So I wrote my first book on a guy named Edward L. Bernays, the so-called father of public relations, and I called it The Father of Spin. If I had a chance to take back that title, I might call Bobby the Father of Spin.
We're talking with Larry Tye about his new book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Larry Tye about his book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. We talked about, just talking about the relationship between Bobby and Jackie Kennedy. What about Jackie and Ethel?
Not the closest. Ethel was the one who, by most of the other siblings, became a sister. She was the one who fit in easily. Jackie was the one who, when they would have these perpetual athletic contests, she'd be sitting on the sideline, incredibly bored. It was a relationship of people with different personalities. It was a relationship of competition, and they, off on the side, would each sort of crack jokes about the other that showed the tension.
It was interesting. There's a point in the book where you talk about Ethel says to Jackie, "We'll share him." But then when it looks like, you know, Bobby's going to do well, he might become president, and Jackie says something like, "It'll be great that we get back into the White House," and Ethel says, "We? What do you mean, we?"
Yes. So you've said it better than I could. And it's just it was a relationship of competition as well as being sisters-in-law.
Let's talk a little bit about the Hyannis compound there. That was really home for Bobby Kennedy. I mean, he lived a lot of other places, but that was home.
So Hyannisport was exactly what Joe Kennedy had dreamed it would be. It was a refuge and a sanctuary where they could come. There were 9 Kennedys, which were just enough for their own softball team. It was a place where they could come to relax. It was a place where they could come to escape the media. And it was a place where they could come and bond with one another the way that Joe thought was essential. He realized that in life, they would take lots of heat from political opponents, from people who were jealous of what they were, and that in the end, the people they could trust the best were their siblings and their parents and their kids.
And not only for Bobby was this a sanctuary, but Ted Kennedy, too. I mean, going out sailing, they all had that love of the water.
And it still is for Ethel and for the Kennedy kids.
And then Bobby wasn't always opposed to the war in Vietnam, he said, but he changed his mind.
You're being kind. The truth is that Bobby was one of the strongest advocates of our sticking in Vietnam, of our winning in Vietnam. He had gone over there. He was one of the authors of our strategy of counterinsurgency. And until he was proven wrong and we weren't winning in Vietnam, he thought we ought to stay there and ought to be loyal. That was the initial Bobby take. The second Bobby take was when he actually stood up and in a very rare event in the U.S. Senate, a senator admitted he was wrong and said, look, we've got a change on Vietnam, and I know that I'm one of the people you can blame for getting us in there, but it's time for all of us to admit our mistakes and get out.
Some might say he was a flip-flopper on many issues.
So with our appropriately cynical attitude about politics today, that would be the term that we would stick him with. I would say that he showed that politicians could actually have transformative, deeply held change in their life. He went from being a guy who was not just a cold warrior to a hot-blooded liberal, but being with a guy we all have within us, Mindy, some balance of toughness and tenderness. Bobby Kennedy went from being a guy who was mainly tough to being a guy by the end who I think was mainly tender.
Also shows that you can change somebody's mind when you give them the right, you know, education and information.
So we all in America want to believe in redemption, and Bobby Kennedy is a good argument for it.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about his relationship with Lyndon Johnson.
So I said that Bobby had 3 enemies. We've talked about 2 of them. One was Roy Cohn. The second was Jimmy Hoffa. Possibly his worst and least deserved enemy was Lyndon Johnson. These were 2 guys who came from different worlds. One grew up dirt poor in East Texas, education and institutions none of us have ever heard about. The other grew up dirt rich in Hyannisport and in Palm Beach and had every opportunity, including Harvard. And they came from different worlds. They saw one another as interlopers, especially after Jack died. Each of them saw themselves as the natural inheritor of his crown. Had the 2 of them not despised one another that way and done everything they could to undermine one another, they might have been one of the great political alliances everywhere, anywhere in American history. They both believed passionately by the end in civil rights. They both wanted to do anything they could to end poverty. And could you imagine if you had Bobby Kennedy's Kennedy charm and Lyndon Johnson's behind the scenes maneuvering what they could have done to make America a different place?
Yeah, people might not remember, but he was a master maneuver behind the scenes, Lyndon Johnson.
LBJ was as savvy as Boston, as Bobby Kennedy was, and as much as he was the father of spin, Lyndon Johnson could work backroom deals better than anybody had ever dreamed of.
Talk about the time he goes out to see LBJ in Texas and they decide to go do a little hunting.
So LBJ called it hunting. Bobby Kennedy called it a slaughter. And I think that they went up on some rise where they were shooting down and the deer that they were shooting had no chance. And Bobby Kennedy thought that was just horrible. Lyndon Johnson loved the fact that Bobby didn't know how to use a rifle. And I don't know how to use a rifle, so I don't know exactly what kind of backdraft it creates. But it did something that made Bobby
lurch
backwards.
Because he gave him really large. He gave him a big rifle, gun.
One that wasn't suited to Bobby's stature, but that also wasn't suited to Bobby's not knowing at all how to handle a rifle. And when the recoil caused Bobby to recoil, LBJ thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, and you can't help but wonder if that was set up, right?
I think everything was set up.
Yeah, everything was set up. And so talk a little bit about LBJ's. He had this insecurity. He taped everything. And Bobby knew that. And there was a conversation where LBJ thought he had the tape of this conversation.
So Bobby Kennedy was the master secret taper of everything that was going on in the White House cabinet room. And he goes into a meeting with LBJ where they're going to be talking about whether Bobby would be LBJ's vice president. The notion that that could have ever happened was inconceivable, but they both had to go through the motions. And Bobby thought that LBJ would be secretly taping the meeting. He was right. He brought in some sort of an interferer, and this device made it so that LBJ's tape didn't work. And LBJ knew he had been outfoxed in that situation, and he was partly angry and partly laughed.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me in reading this, too, is just, you know, how crooked policy from all sides. And this isn't just, you know, the Democrats. It was Democrats and Republicans. Votes were bought. You know, it was really kind of amazing looking at where we were, and you think, gosh, I hope we aren't doing that today.
Yes. So the good news is that if we were doing it today, the chance of people getting caught would be much higher. I think that the dirty tricks that went on back then and the laughably dirty tricks were just extraordinary. And I think that the idea of what the press was willing to keep its mouth shut about was also extraordinary.
Yeah. What was the biggest surprise for you in the research in this book?
It was partly that Bobby Kennedy's period with Joe McCarthy in his early conservative days have been written off by lots of scholars and definitely by the Kennedy myth makers as being an asterisk or a footnote when they were neither. It was how much Bobby had this heartfelt change, how much he grew by experience. And it was that this guy could learn. And if I could tell one really quick story.
Oh, go for it, yeah.
So to me, one of Bobby Kennedy's best learning moments was when he and a bunch of senators go down to Jackson, Mississippi to hearings about hunger in America. And they all come away from the hearing shocked that there is supposedly this kind of hunger in America. Most of the senators do what senators are good at doing. They flew back to Washington and to their comfortable weekend life there. Bobby Kennedy and one other senator said, "I want to see what you've been telling us about." He goes out with a couple civil rights lawyers, including Marion Wright, who later became Marion Wright Edelman, and he goes to black shacks in the Mississippi Delta, America's breadbasket, and in trying to understand what was going on, he goes into this shack, a very poor family with only peanut butter in the refrigerator, with a clothesline in their living room, and he gets down on the dirt floor in his business suit with a toddler who is playing with his food on the floor. For the next 15 minutes, thinking that nobody is watching what he's doing, Bobby Kennedy tries to make eye contact, make some contact with this toddler. The toddler has a bloated stomach that suggests malnutrition, clearly some developmental disability. And for 15 minutes, with flies flying overhead, Bobby Kennedy is tearing up. Tears are coming down his face. He can't make any contact. And afterwards, other politicians, if they ever did what he did, would have ingested the experience, but it would have been the end of it. Bobby Kennedy goes back to Washington and does two things. He insists successfully that the Secretary of Agriculture change the rules for the food stamp program, recognizing that some people can't afford the fee that they're going to pay, that there are actually people in America with zero income. So he gets more food to more people. Then he goes home to his family in their estate in McLean, Virginia, and he tells his kids as they're sitting at Sunday dinner, "You don't get that there are people in the size of our living room, there are families of 15 living there, and you have to, at some point in your life, do something to help these people." And it was a speech that his kids can recite verbatim 50 years later because it moved them so much. That was the kind of learning and changing and empathy that Bobby Kennedy showed.
Mm. There's another story you're telling that stood out to me in the book. And this was some kids who visited him, a girl in a wheelchair. Tell me if I'm getting this right. And he said, "Oh, you want to talk to the president?" He picks up the phone. But he did these things and tell them, "Don't report this in the press." He
told reporters who were watching him, "Don't put it in the newspaper." He did it spontaneously. And he did it in a way that everybody who experienced one of those things, with me 50 years later, could again remember every detail because it changed their life.
Yeah. And the speech that he gave to his kids, I mean, that was sort of the kind of the Kennedy, one of the Kennedy, public service was important in that family.
Public service was important. And one of the other speeches, his other very famous set of speeches, were when he went to South Africa at a time when no American politicians were going to South Africa, and gave speeches that were so moving that his tour guide in South Africa at the time, the vice president of the student union who showed him around, years later comes to Massachusetts, emigrates from South Africa to the United States, comes to Massachusetts. A woman named Margaret Marshall becomes the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, authors the opinion on gay marriage that becomes the opening up of gay marriage to the country. And she says that the single person who influenced her in everything that she's done subsequently was Bobby Kennedy and what he said in his speeches in South Africa.
Mm. Talk about his assassination. This was, security was not like what it is today, that's for sure.
So he had essentially one real security guy, an ex-FBI agent, who wasn't there with Bobby when he went into that kitchen. This is the night that he has his biggest political victory ever, the California primary. He's at the Ambassador Hotel in L.A. He's exiting from his victory speech to meet with reporters. He goes through the kitchen. His security guard wasn't there because Ethel was 10 months or so pregnant, and he was helping her get off the stage. Bobby goes into that kitchen. He is gunned down by a guy who resents his stand in support of Israel, a Palestinian named Sirhan Sirhan. And in that moment, we have a chance that night to build a coalition like we're still dreaming about between blacks and Hispanics and blue-collar whites. In that moment, it all ends. And in that moment, we're left with one of the most hopeful politicians ever shut down at his moment of greatest hope.
Yeah. So did your perception of Bobby change with the writing of this book?
So I started out with Bobby Kennedy as my hero. I looked at everything he had done wrong in the course of his life, and I came out at the end with Bobby Kennedy as my hero. Only by the end, he was a flesh and blood hero with all of his vulnerabilities. But where he ended up in the end was so hopeful that that's the kind of hero I still want.
Mm. And talk about politics today. What lessons we learn from this that we can use today?
So one single lesson, again, by a very quick story. The story is that in a moment where America was facing the same racial tensions that we've seen in Baton Rouge, in Dallas, in St. Paul, that was the moment when Martin Luther King was gunned down. Bobby Kennedy was campaigning in Indiana. That night, he was told by the mayor of Indianapolis, Richard Lugar, who became a famous senator, "You will not go into your planned rally in the middle of the black ghetto in Indianapolis." Bobby Kennedy said, "Thanks for the advice, goodbye," and he went into the rally. He got up on the back of a flatbed truck. He threw out the remarks his aides had written down for him, and he delivered the most pitch-perfect six-minute speech that I think any white politician has ever given about racial justice in America. He talked for the first time about his brother Jack's being killed and how angry he was and how he wanted vengeance. But he talked about how, at a moment like that, we all had to come together as a country and realize whether it was a white or black who was shooting or being shot, that we were one America, that those people were outliers. He found the tone that everybody from Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump to Barack Obama have been looking for. The evidence that it worked was just about every major city in America had a race riot that night. The one glaring exception was Bobby Kennedy's Indianapolis.
Mm. Larry Tighe, the book is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. Thanks so much for coming. Really enjoyed the book. Very, very good research. Thanks so much for sharing it with us.
Thanks for having me back on.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.